Hi, Jim.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Fine. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV. You're James Traub, the noted columnist for foreign policy. Even as we speak, people can go to foreignpolicy.com and find your column Terms of Engagement, if they want. And you're also a fellow at the Center on International Cooperation, which sounds like something I'm in favor of.
Yes, they do lots of worthwhile things. They study things like peacekeeping. I mean, generally conflict issues, conflict resolution. They put out a document called Global Peace Operations for every year, mm-hmm. which describes peacekeeping operations. Barney Rubin, who is a very important figure for the AFPAC office of the State Department, also works as a consultant there, so they do a lot of stuff that I am not at liberty to talk about because it is so secret and important about AFPAC issues.
Well, maybe we could talk afterwards about a little, transmission of documents, if you know what I'm saying. Because what I understand that the Obama administration is fine with that when it happens. When, you know,
they are only going to indict, I think, their own employees. They will, of course, go through all of my stuff, but I'm hoping they won't indict me.
Right. But his new, I gather, new policy he announced a few days ago means that he will not call in drone strikes against either of us now.
That is only if we stay on American soil. I mean, just remember that if we do go to a foreign country, then we are still potentially hittable.
That's true. So much for due process. Well, actually, I want to talk about that shortly. The new Obama's attempt to wind down the war mm-hmm. on terrorism. There's a lot of other stuff to talk about, too. I want to talk about John Kerry, whom you've written about repeatedly. I wanted to start off with something that's maybe more in the news than anything else foreign policy-wise, which is Syria. I guess the latest alarming news for anyone who hasn't been paying attention is that Hezbollah, the Lebanese political party slash militia, has acknowledged that it's involved in the fight on the side of the Syrian regime and says that it's in it until the end. And this seems to me, you know, there's been a lot of talk about this spilling over and turning into a larger regional war. This seems to me like one of the most plausible steps in that direction. Well, what's your take on how things are looking in Syria?
I feel like every horrible thing that the people who were opposed to American involvement have ever predicted would happen is now happening. Right, because the people who said, I'm really sorry that tens of thousands of people are being slaughtered, but believe it or not, it could be worse if the United States gets in. This is the kind of thing they predicted. And I think the question from the point of view of what the heck should we do is, has this been caused by the decision of the United States not to get in? I think the answer probably is no. This would have happened if the U.S. had gotten in or not. And more importantly, right now, does this mean, since this terrible prediction has come true, that these people who were opposed to American engagement in the war have been making, therefore, don't get in because we're getting into an unimaginable a Donnybrook? Now, there I would say no. But, you know, the argument about what the U.S. should do and what the U.S. hopes to accomplish by doing whatever it would do changes every week. Because the situation mm-hmm. has changed so rapidly. So if you had said to me 6 months ago, what do you think we should do? And I wrote a column about this, like everybody in my line of work has. And at the time, I said that I thought the United States should arm the rebels, or at the very least make sure that the arms get to the right people, and probably should be walking around handing money to people, kind of the way the CIA did with the Mujahideen in the late 70s. In Afghanistan, though I know that's not the world's nicest sounding analogy. And at the time, if you had said, what is it you hope to accomplish by that? I would say, well, that would tip the balance of forces in such a way that it would persuade President Assad of Syria that he had to leave because otherwise he was going to die. And then the big question is, what in the world is going to fill that vacuum? Well, that is a different world. We're not even talking about that anymore. And so the burden on people like me who still argue that we should be doing so, that we should be trying to tip that balance in Syria, is to explain what kind of endgame you'd be talking about. Because Assad's not going to leave now, I don't think. I think he's going to fight to the death, the way we all assumed Gaddafi would do in Libya, and the idea that there's a thing called the opposition that we would like to see take over Damascus. That doesn't seem to be true either anymore, because the opposition is almost as fragmented within itself as the opposition is from the government itself. And so whatever right. outcome we're talking about is almost going to be – the best outcome is almost as bad as the worst outcome we would have imagined 6 months ago.
Yeah, and I think – I mean, one thing about intervening in a kind of incremental way is that, you know, with whatever – no-fly zone, arming the rebels. You know, as a matter of American domestic politics, that puts the president, you know, commits the president to ultimately see the end of the regime. I mean, there's just mission creep built into that, you know?
Well, but is there? What's the mission? If the president has already said Assad must go, which after all he said a very long time ago, the problem is he said Assad must go in a way that then I think you could say it was plausible. He must go through a political process, a negotiated process. That was plausible right. then. It was a fair argument to make, and clearly it's what we want. That's not true now. So I think the administration now is I wouldn't say deluding themselves. I think they know better. But it feels disingenuous now. He must go through a political process, but he won't.
But I don't think it was plausible then, because I didn't hear anyone articulating some sort of option for Assad, some sort of alternative to fighting that involved anything other than winding up being tried for war crimes,
well,
right?
Well, no, I mean, I think I can tell you what the not the plausible, the optimistic scenario a year ago was, that Putin would decide that Assad was going. Therefore, Putin would – he doesn't care about the ethics of this whole thing, right? I mean, he just wants to have a beachhead in the Middle East, and the beachhead was Syria. Putin's going to decide Assad is going. The U.S. then goes to Putin and says, look, what you care about is still having influence in Syria, whether Assad's the president or not. So we're going to figure out a way where you're going to be comfortable with that. You are then going to go to Assad and say, buddy, it's up. It's finished. You're over. We're going to withdraw support from you. You can go to Russia. You can go to Saudi Arabia. You can go to southern France. Whatever the heck it is you want to go, you can go. And, you know, just as in Yemen, the insurgents had to agree to basically hold President Saleh harmless, you know, no war crimes tribunal, some stuff like that. The rebels would agree to that, too. Well, was it plausible that Putin would agree to that? It was possible. I mean, it didn't happen. It was possible.
Well, why is it less possible now, in your view?
Well, a couple of things. One is Putin was just way more dug in on this, even then, than we thought. So I would say the whole process that began with Kofi Annan and then Lakhdar Brahimi trying to negotiate this issue probed Russian willingness, and the Russians turned out to be as dug in as the Iranians were. So it, you know, tried, failed. Second, as the defections from Assad's military have slowed, and as Assad has shown his determination, and as the hardcore Alawites have concluded that it's his God or Damarung, you know, it's a fight to the death. They don't have a choice. They can't.
And, you know, it may be, by the way, I mean, just as you said, there's no telling what the opposition would do once it prevailed. And the slaughter of Alawites is a real in-game prospect.
Yeah, but it's way more plausible now. I mean, this is the horrible thing that these guys do. I mean, the analogy that I think about is in Sudan with Darfur, where if you looked at the beginning of the process in 2003, it was a combination of a political protest with a kind of noble insurgency. It was a little bit like what Syria looked like, I don't know, in the summer fall of 2011. And what these really brutal dictators understand is that if they resist fiercely enough, they can wait for time to convert the process so that whatever moral clarity existed at the beginning comes to an end, because the insurgents, who get desperate and enraged, begin acting in the same way or different ways but just as badly as the government. And so they can completely muddy the kind of clear lines or semi-clear lines that existed before. And it seems to me that's what's happened in Syria. So now there's every reason for the Alawites to think that if Assad leaves, they're going to be butchered, which is why it's God or Damarung for them, or feels
right.
like it.
Well, here's my question is, you know, there is a certain amount of talk about Assad now trying to maneuver to wind up with a rump state, you know, to a basically yes. Alawite or maybe right. Alawite and Christian yeah. state, more or less, on the west,
on the Lebanese
in the western
border,
part.
Along the Lebanese border.
Right, right. The Lebanese border and along the sea there.
Right.
A lot of beachfront property would be, in fact, all the beachfront property would be in the state if he his rump
so
state.
So the point is, if we're going to do Club Med Syria, it's going to be an Alawite Syria.
And from the Russian point of view, it'd be nice because, of course, they would still have their port.
Right.
What I haven't heard much of, almost none of, is serious discussion of whether, you know what, maybe this is the most humane, plausible solution. In other words,
I think
partition as an actual diplomatic goal.
Right. Right.
Now, have you heard anybody talking about that?
As a thing to be negotiated to, no, not so far
right.
as I know. But I think you've made a very good point that it's think about the moment when Joe Biden and Les Gelb of the Council on Foreign Relations wrote an op-ed piece in the Times, I think in 2006 or so, when things were going from terrible to unspeakable in Iraq. And they
right.
said, you know what? This country's not viable. Let's turn it into
right.
not three countries, three extremely autonomous regions of one extremely federal entity.
Right.
And I have to say, the way things are going in Iraq right now, that's pretty
right.
reasonable-looking proposition, though it's too late to do it, I think.
Yeah.
And so in the case of Syria, another example, by the way, would be the Bosnian-Herzegovinian, super complicated, three-headed republic. Again, a thing that once upon a time looked like a coherent entity, and then somebody detonated this kind of depth charge of ethnic and racial hatred and suddenly became
right.
unsustainable. So what do you do? And I think that's why I say that the most positive scenario was worse than the least positive scenario from before. I think at this point, the most positive scenario might be some kind of, I would say again, tripartite state, because you would have
mm-hmm.
a Kurdish entity, an Alawite entity, and a Sunni entity. In other words,
yeah, but
you couldn't do the Lebanon thing where everybody has the piece of a whole national thing. You'd have this broken up into pieces thing.
But why not make it just three separate states? I mean, it seems to me that that's what actually allows people to kind of relax the most in a certain sense, you know? I mean, and how many examples are there of a successful kind of quasi-partition? You know, in other words, technically a federation and not separate states.
No, of course,
you know,
once ethnic tensions have gotten
as bad as they are here, I mean.
The United States, after Holland and Switzerland, gave the world the example of a federated republic. So the world is full of those things, and the question is how much autonomy do you give to the federated bits? But I think you're
right.
No, but I'm sorry, that's sort of a semi-serious point. The serious point would be these guys hate each other. They want to slit
right.
each other's throats. How can you
right.
talk
that's
about having
point.
Them? So I think it's a fair point. You know, an Alawite state could only survive – as an Iranian satellite, but presumably that's what it would be. And, you know, Hezbollah, I think one reason, you know, you ask, why is Hezbollah doing this? I mean, I think this is going to be Hezbollah is going to find itself in the position that the United States finds it's in, you know, which is its constituents are going to say, why are we dying for this thing? You know, and I think the answer that Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, will give is because we're only survivable with Syria because it is through Syria that Iran funnels weapons to us. And so
right.
they're not doing this out of Shiite solidarity. Right. They're doing this because I think their survival and their thriving depends.
Right.
So
that
rump Syria, that Alawite Syria, would be the kind of instrument through which Iran would continue to supply Hezbollah.
But would it be as effective? I mean, I profess ignorance about the geography of the transmission belt here. I mean, people say, and it's true, that Syria is a transmission belt for getting weapons from Iran to Lebanon. But you know, of course, Syria does not abut Iran.
No, right, correct.
So things are either going in airplanes or they're passing via ground over
or by sea
Iraqi territory. And I don't understand
sea.
Which or what the deal is. Do you know the details of this? Because
you know, it's a good question.
It matters because this rump Syria state would no longer be connected even to Iraq. So.
Correct.
You know, to the extent
that Iraq
is
Mediterranean, it would have a port, is what it would have. It would have the
right,
port
and there would be a buffer. There would be a buffer of Sunnis between a presumably Sunni state, of Sunni and or you know a Kurdish, between it and Iraq. So it might be that this rump state Syria would be seem less threatening to Israel in particular, although far from ideal, of course, but still less threatening than the current Syria, which stretches all the way to Iraq.
Although, as a
practical matter, it no longer does.
I don't think that's Israel's point. Israel, actually, you know, for a long time, you know, they viewed Assad. I mean, remember, Israel came very close in the fall of 2007 to reaching what they thought was going to be a deal. With Assad, you know, and
this was the Turkish mediated
thing. Prime Minister Olmert was meeting with Prime Minister Erdogan of Turkey, and they were he was about to be meet directly with either Assad or a high ranking official from Syria in the hopes of reaching some kind of peace deal, which would demilitarize the Golan Heights and basically remove Syria from its role as frontline state. Now, would that have ever happened? I don't know. Israeli officials whom I know say that's Olmert's fantasy.
Israel
very close, so who knows?
But Israel, as I understand it, and this is really annoyed Erdogan to no end, apparently, that at that point, the Israeli incursion
into Gaza.
Into Gaza Correct. Began, and from Erdogan's point of view, that blew the whole thing apart, and he was mad at the Israelis for quite a while.
That's absolutely correct. The Israelis have a slightly different claim, but I think the Turks have a very plausible claim that this thing was going on in December of 2007. The specific Turkish complaint is that Olmert, who was having what seemed like a genuinely confidential relationship with Turkish authorities, including Erdogan himself, didn't say a word to Erdogan, suddenly attacks Gaza, making Israel even more persona non grata in the Middle East than they already were, making Erdogan look like an idiot because he's having...
Right.
So, now, the Israeli point of view is, are you kidding? You wanted us to tell Erdogan that we're going to attack Gaza? Not on your life. Anyway, so it all ended very badly, and we don't know how close they ever got, but all I want to say is that Israel had gotten used to the idea of Assad as having these sort of two separate identities. The person who was willing to talk, to do business with them, and the person who was the sponsor of Hezbollah. And so from their point of view, that Assad then is significantly preferable to what they fear would be a highly Islamist, a Sunni state, which was what the current insurgency would turn into if it took Damascus.
So you think they actually fear the loss of the regime more than the survival?
They don't
of the
know
regime.
What they want. Israel really
yeah,
does
yeah,
not
the,
know
I
what
think they're
they
ambivalent
right now. They
so
don't like any of the choices they've got.
Here's a question, and first of all, I should, of course, concede that, you know, partition always sounds doable in principle, and then you start looking at the ethnic map. And you realize, well, it's kind of complicated. It's not, you know, there's a lot of overlapping ethnicities, islands of ethnicities within other ethnicities. It's complicated. And usually when you wind up with partition, or often in the course of these civil wars, it winds up being something like ethnic cleansing that renders the thing more ethnically coherent.
Right.
There have been examples of peaceful population transfer between Greece and Turkey, but by and large, you know, it's an ugly thing. So with that as a concession, I still wonder why, given how bad all the alternatives look, why no one is talking about partition as a diplomatic goal. And I want to throw out the hypothesis that it has something to do with the demise of realism as a serious foreign policy voice in Washington. Does that make sense?
No.
Okay. Well, what do you attribute it to?
Bob, I think your argument for partition as an explicit diplomatic goal is a really good one, and I suspect we may very well wind up there. The reason why your hypothesis doesn't make any sense is that Washington is now the home of realists, and honestly has been. I mean, this is now a long conversation about what do you call the animal that is Barack Obama, and you cannot reduce him to a label. He's too complicated and too elusive and protean for that. But it is easier to say, to talk about the people he has surrounded himself with. And so this is a very interesting subject to me, because I don't know to what extent Obama is conscious of all this. But he has clearly chosen to surround his topmost tier of people, which meant in the first term, Gates, Hillary Clinton, James Jones, and so on, were all people who were one flavor or another of realist. Some of them didn't have views clear enough to be called anything. I don't know that James Jones was anything. He was a military guy.
I think Jones was kind of realist. I'm not so sure about Hillary Clinton, but anyway.
Okay, another big subject. I mean, Hillary, if I can depart for a second, because watching Kerry has clarified something about Hillary and shows me the way in which she is not, it's not that she's not a realist, it's that she's working on a different, her X and Y axis were a little bit different. You know, people talk a lot about how we live in this post-sovereign world and the issues are no longer the old-fashioned issues between states, but actually these big cross-cutting issues and so forth. Hillary was actually quite adapted to that world. So when Hillary talked about issues of the empowerment of women, for example, she would say, well, that's what a diplomat should be doing, should be focusing on these big, broad issues. Economic development, big issue for her. Whereas at the same time, she did not choose to thrust herself into the center of the big diplomatic struggles. You know, she had George Mitchell to do Israel-Palestine. She didn't seek to take the leading role in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and so forth. Mm-hmm. You look at John Kerry. John Kerry has very little to say about democracy, about the empowerment of women. He talks about human rights. He really does care about that stuff. But he is a classic diplomat of the, you could say, of the Cold War era or of the pre-Cold War era. He accepts the way things are in these places. And by the way, Kerry spent 30 years getting to know every dictator in the Middle East and their kids and their wife and their mother and smoking cigars with them and having them to dinner and feeling very proud of all that. That's the world
including Assad, right?
He was a one-man argument that we could do business with Assad. And he doesn't like to talk about that so much now, but it's a fact. So Kerry is actually a traditionalist. He's a realist in the sense that he is less interested in trying to change the kind of human and moral facts on the ground and more interested in saying, what can we do to use those facts to our own advantage? Hillary, I don't think, was different in the idealistic, realistic sense. She was different in the sense of being oriented towards this post-sovereign world.
But I would say that, for example, the emphasis on women's issue tends to run against the grain of realism.
The real realist idealist question really has to do with issues of human rights and democracy, right? Because the premise of realism is that states have more or less rational interests. That is to say, their interests are dictated by their geographical position, their economic position, and so forth. And so what you should be dealing with is the way in which states seek to advance their interests. The way states run themselves inside, are they democracies, are they autocracies, it doesn't matter. They'll have the same interests no matter what. That's the way a realist thinks. Now, the idea, for example, of democracy promotion, which is states will behave differently towards us if they are different inside. This is an idea that actually goes back a long way in American history, but of course we really associate with George Bush and the freedom agenda and so forth. George Bush began his career as a realist. He thought all this moralistic stuff, he associated that with Bill Clinton. This is imperial overreach and moralism and liberalism gone wild and so forth. That's what he thought, because he was advised by people who thought that, like Condoleezza Rice. 9/11 totally changed that, and George Bush, who had really never thought about any of this stuff, suddenly discovered, oh, I know what I am. I'm a democracy promoter. I believe in change. We have to change the insides of countries. So that's the difference to me, the salient difference between a realist and whatever you call the other thing, an idealist, whatever you want to call it.
I take your point that there are some possible really important strands of realism in the Obama administration, perhaps more so now that Kerry is the Secretary of State, it's a good occasion to talk a little more about Kerry. Before we do that, I want to clarify that when I said an absence of realism accounts for the absence from the debate of this negotiated partition solution, I was not actually referring to the administration, which I grant you might find itself moving that direction. I was talking about the chattering classes. They are so, you know, if you look at the Washington think tank structure, the right is dominated pretty much by neoconservatism and, in any event, a very moralistic kind of foreign policy. And the left has a very heavy emphasis on, you know, human rights. Some of the interventions the interventions on the left very often are justified in terms of human rights.
Correct. And so are they on the right, by the way. I mean, this is where the left and the right of foreign policy join up.
Correct.
Is the question of the moral responsibility that comes with American power.
Right. And you tell me, like, what big think tank or what big group of influential journalists doesn't align it well?
Oh, I can tell you very easily the answer to that question. The big ones don't. I mean, the Council on Foreign Relations, the current head is Richard Haass. The previous head was Les Geld. You cannot find two people who are more arch-realists than they are, okay? And the council, if there was a kind of capstone institution in American foreign policy, it is without question the Council on Foreign Relations.
But their fellows, their array of fellows don't really reflect that.
No, I mean, to some extent, that's true.
Look at today's New York Times. Look at today's New York Times. I don't know if you read this piece by Ray Takai, a Council on Foreign Relations fellow. Technically, he was saying either don't get into Syria or get in big. I read him as his heart being in let's get in big. And that's not what realists like Les Geld were saying.
But so that's an interesting question. But I would say Syria has been to come back to Syria, and this makes me realize how much over the years we're going to be coming back to Syria because it is such a hugely searing event. And the way Iraq has given us incredibly painful lessons about acting.
Mm-hmm.
And Syria is going to give us a set of lessons about not acting. And you know, we don't know yet who's going to turn out to feel that they were right about choosing to not act. But in the case of Syria, if you were to – I don't know who you'd have to how you would decide on the universe to pull. But in the kind of universe of serious foreign policy thinkers, the fraction of people who from the outset have said don't get involved is at least as great as the people who have said get involved. Different from Libya, by the way, where the balance was different and for obvious reasons, which is an easier thing to do. And so, no, I am not as convinced as you are, I think, that there is this kind of a tidal wave of moral outrage on the subject. I'm on the moralistic side of all this. I mean, I am in favor of acting for reasons I'd be happy to get into, from the beginning, but after a certain point. I think actually we live so much in a post-Iraq world that the sense of having been chastened by the failure, not of the war itself, but of all of the efforts to change and improve from our point of view, these very refractory cultures in the Middle East has made a lot of people, me included, way more wary than they were before, not only about military interventions, but all sorts of interventions.
Yeah. Now, I think that's true. There are a lot of gun-shy people, but what I'm seeing as a very common theme in the commentary from left and right is the kind of sometimes unspoken assumption that look, because Assad is the bad guy, we cannot let him get out of this with anything intact, right? I mean, that so far nobody is – I'm not hearing anybody saying, wait a second, maybe the thing that will lead to the least slaughter going forward is for him to have his damn rump state. I'm not hearing that. And I don't know why. Maybe there's another. Maybe I'm wrong. But to me, the absence of that from the dialogue says something about an absence of old-fashioned realism. But maybe I don't know why.
I mean, I think it's a genuine. I mean, you've asked a really interesting question, and I don't have a good answer to the question of why. I mean, I think the answer to the question of why this hasn't yet been raised is that only as the tide has turned back towards Assad? Has it been even, you know, have you had to think, okay, you know, what's a next best solution after the guy getting out of leaving power?
And the other thing is the prospect of regional war is now becoming so tangible that I think there's more reason than ever to ask yourself, what is the fastest way to get to a stable solution,
But let's go to the substance of this. So we have to ask ourselves, what would cause Assad to leave Damascus and remove to his mountain fastness in the Alawite Mountains? And it seems to me now more than ever, given the support of Iran and Russia, nothing save the prospect of almost certain military failure would do so. And so the thing you would have to do in order to get him to accept this lesser diplomatic solution is not too different from the thing you would have to do in order to get him to leave Syria altogether. Because it's not only that he's dug in, it's that he has now convinced all his entire Alawite population that win or die are their only two choices.
He's not even thinking
that leaving Damascus, he'd get killed by his own people.
Yeah, I mean, survive or die. In other words, he hasn't convinced them they have to retake all of Syria that they've lost. But yes, he's convinced them that they have to remain intact as a state of some size. Now, he would like it to include Damascus. I mean, you can imagine a rump state that does. I don't know how much of the Sunni population has already left Damascus, so I don't have any idea how practical that becomes. But
Damascus, this is the problem with when you thought about with Iraq, with all of these countries. The capital city is always a metropole. And so it's cosmopolitan. It's full. I mean, Sarajevo, Baghdad, they're all like that. You can't untangle those threads.
Well, actually, it tends to happen in horrific ways when it happens.
It happens through a process of extermination, right?
Well, not necessarily ethnic cleansing, which can involve varying magnitudes of actual death, but population transfer at a minimum.
Well, Baghdad,
so I don't
one
know.
Reason maybe why there was never that tripartite thing in Baghdad, I mean in Iraq, I'm sorry, is that it was almost impossible to imagine
the kind of population
take in Baghdad.
Right, because even Baghdad got more segregated itself, but
neighborhood by neighborhood. Right. Again, the same thing
happened
in Sarajevo.
So it's a mess. We can agree on that. On the question of John Kerry, quasi-realist or whatever, do you worry that he's getting a little too ambitious? I mean, you know, funny little story, by the way. In 2011, I had just been to the West Bank, and I went on the kind of the left-wing tour of Israel, which almost nobody does. I mean, most people who go on junkets go on AIPAC junkets.
Right.
This was like a left-wing tour, and so I had seen, some pretty discouraging things. Right after I got back, I found myself on an airplane sitting next to John Kerry.
Guess you were flying business class.
No, it was because it was such a small plane. We were flying to Nantucket, where, as you know, he windsurfs.
Indeed.
There was no first class.
Okay.
So as a result, I was sitting next to him.
Okay.
And I'm not the kind to say, oh, aren't you John Kerry? But I was looking at this map that I had come back from Israel with of the West Bank. And he said, oh, are you, you got a solution to the problem? And I gave him my assessment that, hey, it's too late for, I've concluded it's too late for a two-state solution. I won't rehash my argument here, but he wasn't very curious about the logic behind that. He kind of didn't want to hear it. And anyway, I certainly think we're seeing a man now who is pretty convinced that a two-state solution is still within reach. I'm not optimistic, but what do you think of that and maybe his other efforts?
Look, do you want to have a Secretary of State who is going to err on the side of trying to do what he probably can't do, or a Secretary of State who's going to do the opposite, like, let's say, Warren Christopher, Bill Clinton's first-term Secretary of State,
you know,
kind of nothing ventured, nothing gained? So I don't – well, so going back to the Kerry thing, it's a little bit like I used to write about public schools a lot, so I spent a lot of time in inner-city public schools. And the best teachers who you would meet – had a completely unreasonable expectation of success. And if they didn't have an unreasonable expectation of success, they wouldn't have spent their time teaching kids who were two grades behind grade level when they arrived, because the mm-hmm. chances are it's going to fail. But if you think it's going to fail, you shouldn't be there. And so Kerry sounds so unreasonably optimistic that you think he's naive. He may be unreasonably optimistic, but I think not naive. And so one thing he has said, I mean, I saw him right before he took office. I think he hadn't yet been confirmed. And we had a brief conversation, and one thing he said was something he has now been saying since then, which is, we have 18 to 24 months before the window closes on a possible two-state solution. And I said, because why? What's, you know? And so his argument is essentially a demographic facts on the ground. On the one hand, the increase in Israeli settlements. On the other hand, I suppose he probably also meant the greater Israeli sense of encirclement and embattlement, as the difference between growth rates in Israel and in the Arab states got bigger and bigger. So they thought, oh, my mm-hmm. God, how could we possibly – we're going to be inundated. I'm not even sure specifically what his list of things would be. And so he's doing this with a kind of insane level of urgency because mm-hmm. unlike you and probably unlike me, he thinks it's doable. But then again, unlike a wild-eyed optimist, he thinks it's not going to be doable for long. Now, you know, what you always say in these situations when 18 months comes up and someone says, okay, you're going to give up right now. I said, well, no. You know, it's like with Iran. You know, you set a red line, Iran crosses the red line, but we're not going to bomb them now. So he'll keep pushing it back. You know, but I think overall, though, about all these this flurry of diplomatic activity, it's a good thing because mm-hmm. it is a way of America asserting itself in the world in a not only a non-military way, but in a peace-seeking, idealistic way. And you try a bunch of things, and some are going to fail, and some may work. And if one or two works, that's a whole lot better than none working.
Yeah. No, I like the, I guess, kind of creativity of this thing where he claims to have raised $4 billion from people who are willing to invest it in Palestine. I'm a little unclear on whether, well, first of all, whether he's really raised it, and secondly, on whether that's going to be, how conditional that's going to be on the Palestinians doing things. I guess one good guess is that it's conditional on them coming to the negotiating table without Israel formally freezing settlement construction. Maybe that's one thing that the money's meant to do. Do you have a clear idea of the intended sequence of events here?
I haven't talked to anyone in the State Department about this, you know, in the last week. So I don't know the answer. I mean, it strikes me as being the kind of low-hanging fruit of the negotiation problem. That is, money you can find. I mean, that's mm-hmm. obviously a lot of money. Money is not the problem. And so I think you're right in saying he's hoping that he can bribe the Palestinians into not making demands that will be a non-starter. First of all, I mean, I think beyond anything else, let's say he can raise the $4 billion. Mm-hmm. Does that mean he has already reached an agreement with Abbas that would be enough money for Abbas to say, okay, fine, I'll come with no preconditions?
Right.
If he does that without any willingness on the part of the Israelis to make painful concessions on any of the final status issues, it doesn't matter. And so I think what could happen is if Kerry succeeds, the Palestinians will come to the table for another fruitless round of negotiations, which will further embitter them. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the kind of the terrible thing is that nobody there expects success. The Palestinians don't, and the Israelis don't, but the Palestinians are so beaten down and so exhausted that it's just not that likely that there's going to be a third intifada. And as far as the Israelis are concerned, if there's not going to be a third intifada, then why are we having this conversation? Because things are fine in Israel. The only thing that's not fine is the fear of Palestinian violence.
Yeah, well, that's the there was this Ethan Bronner piece in the Times recently, kind of reiterating what had been a cover story in Time magazine, controversially called "Why Israel Doesn't Care About Peace," some years, a few years ago. But you know, saying basically, look, they're doing well economically. Rehashing the argument that there isn't a lot of Israeli motivation. So I'd like to be optimistic, and I'd like the Israelis to share my belief that if they think they're not facing a long-term problem by leaving this unsolved, they're wrong.
Well, but, so you and I are in the weird position almost of wanting a third intifada, that is a nonviolent one. That is, you want the Palestinians, I mean, of course you want them to be, you know, have a Gandhian movement. There's been a little signs of that, but not...
It's been a little
of
that.
Right? But the only way that Israel is ever going to get off the dime on this is if they think that the status quo is unsustainable. And so what does that mean? That means the Palestinians make the status quo unsustainable.
Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, first of all, this Gandhian... The Gandhian element that is kind of there a little, and I met some of these people when I was in the West Bank, and some of them have been on Blogging Heads since then... These people, they don't get that clear about their long-term goals. They're basically just protesting, you know, the kind of human rights, civil rights situation in the West Bank. But they tend to lean toward a one-state solution. If the Israelis start seeing that as a real prospect, that will get them motivated. You know, if they start imagining that the Palestinians will get a lot of international support for something like a one-state solution, that might light a fire under them. And that's why one thing that does worry the Israelis is the boycotts and sanction and disinvestment movement. Like this, when Stephen Hawking recently basically participated in a boycott of Israel over the occupation, that kind of thing really bothers them. And they do worry about that getting traction internationally the way the anti-apartheid movement got traction internationally. So that's a kind of pressure that's a kind of nonviolent pressure I can imagine changing the calculation, but they're nowhere near that. What's that?
You should be in favor of a boycott?
Well, there's degrees of boycotts. There's boycotts of settlement-produced goods. And, I mean, I'll be honest. I am starting to so despair of any other path to solution. I first of all, that seems okay to me. It's marginal but symbolic. More broadly, my feeling is just like, Let's try weird stuff. You've got to get Israel's attention, you know, and that's why, you know, when Kerry, I guess, successfully dissuaded Erdogan, Prime Minister of Turkey, from visiting Gaza, mm-hmm. I was like, you know, chances are him visiting Gaza, that has at least as good chances of producing something productive in the long run as Kerry's little $4 billion. I mean, you know, we've been here before.
Yeah, but I think as long as the United States, as long as the Israel lobby, I didn't say Jewish lobby, as long as the Israel lobby is as powerful as it is, it means that 90% of the things you might think about doing are not going to happen. At least they're not going to happen from Washington.
Well, I do not – I'm not going to fiercely disagree with you there, Jim. And, of course, talk of sanctions and boycott, that's one reason that there are people in Washington whose mission seems to be to say that anyone who suggests any kind of boycott or sanctions is an anti-Semite. You know, they're working – there are people working hard to kind of stigmatize that approach.
Those people are all Republicans, by the way. I mean, a large part of the Democratic caucus in the House and the Senate buys into the same logic.
Well – they'll certainly say so. I mean, as we know, AIPAC has a fair amount of influence in the legislature.
So they say.
Yeah, they say. It's all pretty depressing.
That's why the pivot to Asia, Bob, right?
Yeah,
Asia,
that's what we need is a pivot to Asia.
Big, peaceful, democratic, successful countries. Let's knock this Middle Eastern dust from our shoes.
Yeah, I mean, that's the funny thing is, like, what... Okay, fine. Asia's important, but what exactly are the resources that need to be shifted from the Middle East? I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm all for pulling troops back from the Middle East, you know. It's just that I'm not for sending them to East Asia.
That's the peculiar thing about, of course, this idea of pivot. You're right, because a pivot only has meaning. You know, we pivoted from Afghanistan to Iraq. We get what that means. Right? All the spooks left Afghanistan and went to Iraq. The drones, all that stuff. So is that going to – no. And so what it means – it seems to me it is – it almost expresses a profound yearning. And the yearning is to no longer be defined by the post-9/11 conflicts and therefore to return to a much happier status quo ante when the world was basically an economic competition as opposed to an existential identity-based competition, which is what the Middle East is all about.
Right.
That would be nice, but it's not going to happen because the Middle East isn't going to let us pivot away from that.
Well, I mean, there is the argument that, which I think I'm willing to put forward, that significantly less involvement in the Middle East, at least in the sense of troops on the ground and drone strikes, would be a good thing.
I couldn't agree more, but I just think those conflicts are going to keep sucking us in.
Well, sure, and we should devote diplomatic energy to them. I'm not arguing for inattention. I'm not arguing for isolationism in that sense. What you just said offers a segue to something I had vowed we would at least touch on, and although we're kind of running out of time, we should touch on it. And this is Obama's, you know, his big speech telling us that the war on terror is – I actually didn't listen to it, but the idea is to wind down the war on terror, much tighter policy governing drone strikes, you know, do something about Gitmo. And, of course, we are apparently extracting troops from Afghanistan and so on. What's your take on that?
My take on that is that Obama never, ever thought he would be this kind of president. I mean, it's not that he thought he would be a domestic policy president and he got bogged down in foreign policy. You know, Woodrow Wilson once famously said in 1913 or something, "Wouldn't it be ironic if I became a foreign policy president?" That's not Obama. Obama thought that if you look back at mid-2007, before the collapse of Lehman, for example, before the economy went completely south, Obama thought that his big job was to recreate America in the world, to make Americans feel better about themselves and to make the world feel better about America, to put a new face on America. And that meant dismantling all of these structures that had been built up by Bush as a result of 9/11. That's how he saw himself. And so what he has found, I'm sure, to his own dismay and perplexity, is that he's been kind of eaten alive by the national security imperatives. You know, and Moynihan wrote decades ago about how in the aftermath of World War II, the United States became what he called a national security state. And his big example of this was that what did the president do first thing in the morning? First thing in the morning, the CIA came and said, "Here's all the horrible things happening in the world." Well, so if you're president, what do you think? You think my big job is to prevent horrible stuff from happening to America. Obama, I think, has really gotten consumed by that. And I don't mean that as a criticism. I think anybody who steps into that office, it happens to them. And now he's thinking, how can I get back to what I thought I was going to do and be? And so, you know, it's only a speech, and B, it's arguable the speech is full of half measures. But I do think the sincere part of it is this wish to somehow become the president he once thought he was going to be.
Yeah. I mean, I think also, I like to think, maybe because it aligns with my own view, is that he's recognized that some of the things he was doing to reduce the chances of terrorism in the short run may have increased the chances in the long run. I mean, the Boston bombers didn't mention drone strikes per se, but some of these terrorists or would-be terrorists have. And in any event, the Boston bombers seem to have been buying into the narrative of al-Qaeda recruiters that America's at war with Islam. What they cited was Iraq and Afghanistan. But, you know, they were buying the narrative. And that is the biggest asset, I think, that al-Qaeda recruiters have. And I kind of like to think that this speech reflected some appreciation of that.
I think that's right. I mean, I think there's a kind of history of this, which is right after 9/11, Bush said, "Why do they hate us? whose answer was, oh, because they don't understand us, so I'm going to send out public diplomats, and they're going to explain what a great country we are.
Right.
Well, you know, that's how naive Bush was. And even Karen Hughes, his great friend, came back and said, actually, they hate us because they think we're backing Israel, and they hate Israel. And if we don't do something about the Middle East, it won't matter what we do. So...
Did she say that? She never said that publicly, right?
She said it to me, actually, for quotation. So it's in my book about democracy promotion. I was quite shocked. She never did say it publicly. So Obama thought, why do they hate us? Well, they hate us because, you know, George Bush and all this darkness and threat. And so there's going to be a new face on America. Well, and so that's what the speech in Cairo was meant to do all that. Well, that didn't work either, because while we're having a new face on America – we have these strange, eerie, super high-tech instruments which kill people from afar. And that became the face of America, not Barack Obama's progressive, black, multicultural, et cetera, face. And so he, too, has come to realize, as you said, that the things he is doing to keep America safe are arguably making it less safe. And so he's trying to find some balance where he's going to keep using drones in a limited way to do a thing that only drones can do, which is take out these bad guys in places that America otherwise can't reach, while at the same time limiting their use so that they don't kill as many civilians. Now, is that going to make the Pakistanis feel better about the U.S.? No, it's not. Is it still necessary to try stuff like that? Yes, it is.
Okay, I mean, my own preference would have been that he articulated an even tighter drone strike policy. I mean, I'd like to see him say, and correct me if he's kind of said this, but I'd like to see him say that, you know, what he said was outside actual combat zones, we won't use drones unless blah, 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 and whatever he said will become a loophole for the next, you know, administration, even if they decide to adhere to his guidelines, unless an American is in peril. What I'd like to see him say is, you know, outside of an actual combat zone, we don't do drone strikes unless we have the explicit, public, formal, advance approval of the government of the state.
Well, that would mean that I'm not going to use drones in Pakistan, though I might use them in Yemen, right?
Yep. Well, actually, I think Yemen, for a time, the government was pretending that they weren't. I don't think they were giving us public approval, were they?
Maybe
they
finally know under Hadi, the new president.
Yeah.
Yes. So the point is, you know, that's an interesting proposition. Should he say, I'm not going to use drones unless the country is willing to own up to it?
Right.
Now, and that's an interesting point, because it would help neutralize the sovereignty argument.
Right.
But then, of course, the government wouldn't own up to it, so you basically wouldn't use drones at all in Pakistan.
Well, they might or might not, but I'm tired of us being used by regimes to, in some cases, do their own dirty domestic business in ways that leads all the blowback to fall on us,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, though I do think that Pakistan, I think the need to – Pakistani regimes have depended on hating the United States, as many Middle Eastern regimes have for a long time.
Right.
And so, you know, what's kind of sticks in all of our craw is we're doing good things for these people. And they're not only do they hate us, their government is like making, you know, basically making hay politically by hating us. So let's knock it off. Now, let us bear in mind, we're not there for them. We're there for us.
Right.
And so I think that sense of kind of a jilted chivalry is a little misplaced. We just have to keep reminding ourselves we're there for us. And so for all the anguish that goes into the relationship with Pakistan and Afghanistan – you know, we stay there not out of our sense of moral purpose, but because it serves our own national security purposes, and we'd like to get out of there as soon as we can, and we will when it's good for us, not when it's good for them. So, all right, so we put up with a certain amount of guff. I mean, that's part of being, you know, the greatest power in the world.
Yeah, well, we've kind of run longer than we generally do,
so we
should probably sign off. I'm willing to let the final line on American foreign policy be your saying that our sense of jilted chivalry is a little misplaced. I would subscribe to that.
I can go with that.
I'm a fan of understatement, which I consider that to be. But thanks so much for doing this, Jim. It's been a lot of fun. I hope you'll come back again in the future.
I'd
and
love
I promise.
To.
I promise that we will do so much advanced planning next time.
And even
you won't have to hold the phone up to your ear.
Yeah.
We will buy you. This is the kind of high budget operation we run here. We will buy you new earbuds.
Wow, I must have really been good.